Good morning. I want to welcome you all to our second case today. And we have students with us. We have students from Lincoln High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have students from Ellsworth High School. Would they please stand?
All right.
Thank you for coming. These students are here with a program sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court. It's called Court with Class. It's a national award-winning program. Students from across the state are invited to come for an oral argument. If they come, they've been given briefs in the case that they're going to hear. They may engage in some activities relating to this case. And the last part is that they will meet with a justice of the court after this second case. Everyone is invited to attend that session. It will deal with the procedures of this court, not the substantive issues of the case that we're about to hear. It's easier to listen to oral argument if you know something about the case. If you would like a summary of the case you're about to hear, if you raise your hand, the marshal will give you the summary. All right. With that said, I'll now introduce the court to you all. On my far left is an empty seat. Justice Ziegler generally sits there, but she is not participating in this case. Justice Ziegler is the justice with whom the classes will meet after this case is concluded. Seated next to the empty chair is Justice Patience Robensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I will now call the second case, 05AP3190, AccuWeb Inc. versus Foley and Lardner. Addressing the court for 25 minutes, representing AccuWeb is Attorney Axelrod. We will then hear 15 minutes from Attorney William Bauer, representing Quarles and Brady, and then from Claude Cavelli, representing Foley, Lardner, and Mr. Engstrom, correct? You will then get 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Axelrod. You may proceed.
Thank you very much, Chief Justice Abrahamson, members of the court. Today I'm substituting for Dan Hildebrand, who was retained by AccuWeb to handle this appeal before he became ill. And in fact, Mr. Hildebrand did the briefs in the Court of Appeals. So I know that I have some big shoes to fill here today, and I hope that I'm up to the task. The basic issue, Your Honor, before the court is whether AccuWeb should be denied its right to a jury trial as to damages after it lost its 414 patent as a result of attorney negligence. And AccuWeb's theory of damages was diminution of value. And that's a theory of damages in cases such as this. That's recognized by this court's decision in the case of Jolin versus Oster. That was a breach of fiduciary duty case. In that case, this court approved the jury instruction that the proper measure of damages was the value of the company before the wrongful act, in that case, the breach of fiduciary duty, had occurred, and what the company would have been worth as a result of the wrongful act, the difference being the measure of damages. The trial court in this case, in dismissing the case on summary judgment, was simply wrong that one must show a sale of the company or one must show patent infringement in order to get past summary judgment. And in fact, the Jolin case is consistent with case law throughout the United States in legal malpractice cases that an appropriate measure of damages is diminution of value. I'm referring to the Campbell versus Rogers case from New York State, which is cited in our brief, the Adams versus Paul case from California that's cited in our brief, and the Nicolay Instrument case versus the law firm of Lindquist and Venom, which is a Seventh Circuit case which applied Wisconsin law. And in that case, the Seventh Circuit held that all you needed to show some harm in order to proceed.
Mr. Axelrod, if I can interrupt you for a minute.
Certainly.
My understanding is that your opposing counsel would say and have said, as this case has moved along, that the only thing that was shown in terms of damages tied into the diminution of value was very speculative, that nothing was established with any degree of certainty. How do you respond to that?
I respond to it in two ways, Your Honor. First, there was the Misero report. The Misero report was issued by an investment banking firm in Chicago. The Misero report compared a damages scenario versus a base case scenario. Certainly, their report was admissible. Judge Albert admitted it. There was never any question as to admissibility. So, by definition, the attack on the Misero report is really fodder for cross-examination. And the problem with what happened in the trial court is that counsel for the defendants did an absolutely excellent job in cross-examining the witness, the author of the report, at his deposition, and that Judge Albert was persuaded by that cross-examination. And, of course, that was not the role of the trial court because cross-examination goes to weight rather than sufficiency. The other issue where speculation came up was the trial court and the two affirming justices of the Court of Appeals, dissenting judge, but the Court of Appeals and the trial court applied this court's decision in the Pluswood plywood case, or Oshkosh plywood case. And that case was a very, very different case, which needs to be distinguished because in that case what happened was that the plaintiff knew that it had suffered damages. The plaintiff knew that as a result of those damages, it had to expend enormous sums for additional labor costs, yet the plaintiff kept no records whatsoever. And as a result of keeping no records whatsoever, this court said that presented a very speculative scenario of damages. And, of course, in this case, it's not anywhere parallel to the Pluswood case because our client didn't know until it received the notice from the defendants that the patent had lapsed. Our client was under the impression that the patent was still in effect, and it was only after the defendants discovered that it had lapsed because of the failure to file or pay the maintenance fee that they notified our clients. Let me
ask you, if I might, about the Teatsworth case. The Teatsworth case. I understand that counsel raised that also, and that's a relatively recent case from this court where we looked at the claim that there might be damages in the future and said, no, that's not enough, that a summary judgment was indeed appropriate. Isn't this very similar to the Teatsworth case in that I understand your client is saying, well, you know, we had an offer for sale of our company for around $12 million. It was reduced to $5 million, but they really can't pinpoint it to the loss of the patent. And then you get into a situation where it becomes, this is the response I understand from your opposing counsel, that what we're talking about is speculative damages because this company isn't for sale. They've refused, apparently, a number of letters inquiring about a sale. And so that adds to the speculation. So how do you get around Teatsworth?
Okay, Teatsworth involved a motorcycle, and there was no evidence of the defect, so no damages. So I think that's readily distinguishable. But I think that the other factor that's important in this case...
There was evidence that there was a problem with these motorcycles. That was conceded
right,
in
but
Teatsworth.
Not a, but not a defect.
The problem in Teatsworth was... Although there was something that should have been repaired or could have been repaired or was a defect in that case, nobody in the class ever had the problem. Nobody ever suffered damages. Their position was, in the future, maybe this defect would produce damages or that it lowered the value of the motorcycle on resale. But there was not even evidence of that, but it was a possibility, as I remember Teatsworth.
I think this case, Chief Justice Abrahamson, is very different because there's really three bases to reverse the trial court. Basis number one is the circumstantial evidence. There was an offer to buy the company. Which had a value of $9.2 million plus keeping cash in the accounts receivable, which brought it up to something over $12 million. That was subject to a due diligence investigation. Immediately after that due diligence investigation was completed, FITEC withdrew their offer. And the circumstantial evidence is that in any due diligence investigation, the job of the attorney or other professional that's retained to do the due diligence is to make sure that all the assets of the company, including the patent, and this court held in the Bohm case that a patent is personal property, are there, that they're in effect, that they're valid. And anybody that's done patent law or works on a patent case knows that it takes about 10 seconds to find out whether a patent is valid. Today they do it on the internet. Back in 1998, they did it by dialing a number in Washington, D.C. of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, punching in the number of the patent and immediately being told.
Counselor, could you get any, I understand they withdrew for, quote, economic reasons. Now that could mean that their company wasn't as strong as they thought and didn't want to do the purchase, or it could go to something like you're describing or something else. Was there any effort made to get a more specific statement from the purchaser?
The record does not disclose that, Your Honor, on behalf of either the plaintiff or the defendants. Certainly the due diligence results may have been privileged if they were done by an attorney and were the result of the communication between the attorney and FITEC. But the circumstantial evidence is simply overwhelming and raises a jury question that why else would a company forfeit $85,000 of a $100,000 deposit and walk away right after the due diligence investigation unless they had discovered something that would have changed the value. And certainly the evidence in this case is that this patent was very valuable to this company. In fact, it had the ultrasonic technology that is the subject of the patent revolutionized this industry and made our client a leader in the industry because it was the only company that was able to keep web rolls, whether they be plastic or paper or whatever was being printed or cut, perfectly centered and compensated for humidity and other things. So this was a very, very valuable part of the company, and I think that the court can conclude that it was legitimately admissible as circumstantial evidence to be allowed to argue to a jury that that was the reason that that offer was withdrawn. So that's basis one. Basis two is the Misero report, and basis three is the testimony of the owners of the company, particularly Ray Bisker. Certainly under the Volkswagen versus Mayberry, Mr. Bisker could give an opinion as to the value of his company. Under the Krasinski case, he could even give an opinion as to what he believed was the state of mind of Phitek. So I think we have three bases to distinguish the case from the motorcycle case. Now, the basic
are you saying, in effect, that the trial court should have drawn a reasonable inference that under the circumstances presented, that this business offer was in effect not available because of the patent? Because you don't have evidence of that.
Well, evidence. You had circumstantial evidence, and we know that that Phitek was still interested in the company, but they wanted to pay $5 million for it instead of over $12 million. So this case should have gone to the jury. This is all about victims of torts being allowed their day in court. And AccuWeb should have had its day in court. I think Judge Dykeman, in his dissent in the Court of Appeals, said it all. He said it may well be that after a jury trial that AccuWeb would not have won its case, but it should have been given its day in court. And the problem with what the trial court did is it cut this case off prematurely. The problem...
May I? Are you finished if you have another sentence?
I'm finished. Okay.
I'm concerned about the focus in this case. Justice Crooks asked the question regarding what's, isn't it speculative? And you respond to what's speculative or not speculative. And I look at the Court of Appeals opinion at paragraph 28, and they weigh in on this issue. And this is the guts, I think, of the speculative analysis, or a big part of it. And in paragraph 28, it says in part, in the middle part of that paragraph, that he testified that he had no information that such a competitor actually existed. Indeed, the Misero report itself affirms that as of the writing of the report, the company is not aware of any competitor marketing products that use the compensation technology disclosed in the 414 patent. And then this is it. Such evidence is required to establish harm that has already occurred or is reasonably certain to occur. And what is in my mind is this. What's the focus? Let me put it another way. I don't think the focus is it reasonably certain, which is the flip side of too speculative, is it reasonably certain that another competitor will use the product? I don't think that's what this case is about. I think this case is about, is it reasonably certain that given the loss of profit, there's a diminution of value? And so I think that maybe the Court of Appeals' focus is wrong. Are you following me at all on that? Am I making any sense to you? No, I sometimes ask that question. Are you following me at all? And then I say, are you making any sense? I only want you to answer the first part of the question and not the second part.
Let me
answer. Objection, Your Honor, double-barreled.
So the first part of your question only. I think what Your Honor is referring to is Judge Albert's determination, and that of the Court of Appeals, too, that there had to be infringement in order for this case to proceed to a jury trial. And that's a very, very basic error in our judgment.
Or there has to be someone there ready to buy. Yeah, I mean.
You have to look at, I'd invite the Court's attention to the Beasley case. It's a federal district court case from Texas. The same argument that the defendants made here was made there, that you had to plead infringement. And the Beasley case rejected that analysis because what the damage is in this case is not that there'll be an infringer, but that there's a risk that there will be an infringer. And that's why you got a patent in the first place. If Pearls and Brady had concluded that it wasn't necessary to patent this because there are no companies out there that would dare use this technology.
I disagree with you in part. Maybe it's drawing a line, a fine line here. But I don't think they have to show with reasonable certainty the risk that there's going to be an infringement. I think that they have to show that there's a diminution in value to a reasonable certainty. And if here I am a buyer, right, I'm going to buy something. And if what I'm going to buy I thought had a patent, and it doesn't have a patent, as a buyer, I likely am going to pay less.
That's exactly right.
I mean, this is, you can talk about fancy things, you can talk about something as easy as, I was going to say a Kool-Aid stand, that's not exactly it, but I mean, very, very simple things, but it boils down to me is there a diminution in value? That is, you know, is a reasonable person who wants to purchase it going to pay less now?
Let me use a hypothetical to answer your question. This patent, had the maintenance fee been paid, would have run until 2009. And during that period, anybody valuing that company, whether it be a potential buyer or whether it simply be an appraiser or whether it be a bank that's going to lend money to that company, is going to value that company by totaling the sum of its assets. And its assets are going to include real property, and it's going to include personal property. And under the Bohm case, a patent is personal property. And the question is an appraiser going to give the company the same value after the patent has expired as the appraiser is going to give before that premature expiration? And the reason the Mesero company concluded that there would be diminution in value is that somebody looking at that company with an interest of purchasing it is going to say, I'm not going to pay as much for that company because there is a risk that an infringer could come in.
There also another quality there, Counselor, that when you have a valid patent, you can license it to others, and so if you no longer have a valid patent, you've lost that opportunity, so that part of a business venture that you could get into is no longer available.
Right. Now, web printing is certainly there are many companies that manufacture web guides for the printing industry. There are many companies that manufacture web guides for the converting industry, whether you're a Band-Aid company that's taking pieces of plastic and converting them into Band-Aids. We certainly have competitors out there, and it's the risk that one of these competitors is all of a sudden going to be able to offer their customers the precision compensation. In other words, your printing, your cutting is always going to be centered
We're going to accept the fact that there's a value in the patent, and I will accept the fact that maybe there was a diminishing value of the company. What proof did you put in to show what that loss was? Now, as you know, damages don't have to be proved with mathematical accuracy, but they have to have a reasonable degree of certainty. So what did you do to show what the value is?
The attorney that represented AccuWeb in the trial court, which was not our law firm, had put in two separate and distinct proofs. The first was all of a sudden a $12.2 million FITEC offer is now a $5 million offer. So that's proof. The other evidence of proof that was put in.
So then you're saying your loss was $8 million?
Under that analysis, Your Honor. Right. Then there was the approach that was taken in the Misero report, which is in the record.
Okay, so you're back into that.
At R51, where Mr. Goldfarb, the author of the report, actually comes up with a base case scenario and a damage scenario, and says that the damages that our client is entitled to is the difference. The trial court, it seems to me, Your Honor, made really two mistakes. The first mistake it made is
it didn't bring in any extra outside appraisers. Other than Misero and
no, certainly an investment banking firm that for a living does appraisals is stands in the same shoes, right, for example, as a real estate appraiser. So the trial court really made two errors. First, it rejected diminution of value, and instead came up with this absolutely silly argument that there has to be an infringement in order to collect damages. And that of course, simply isn't true. It's the risk of an infringer coming in that's the measure of damages. Hopefully there will not be an infringer, but that risk. And the third thing the trial court did is it really misused the summary judgment process. And a basic summary judgment procedure is that you have to take the inferences from the evidence in the light most favorable to the party opposing summary judgment. And in our view, the trial court didn't do that. And instead, the trial court really took found counsel's very good cross-examination effective and carried the day with it. And even today, the Foley and Lardner brief really takes a cross-examination weight of the evidence approach, which I think is wrong. For example, at page 15, Foley complains that the expert's formal education was in chemical engineering, even though the expert also had finance courses and accounting courses and a plethora of experience. Of course, this is a jury question, not something that goes to admissibility. At page 13, Foley argues that when summary judgment was granted in late 2004, AccuWeb was doing very well. Certainly that's a fact for the jury to consider, but under a diminution of value theory, that wasn't the issue. The issue was whether as a result of this very, very valuable patent that has the name of Quarles and Brady on it that they secured, that this piece of paper, after Quarles did all this work, was worth nothing. The defendant's briefs don't really reckon with that. At page 16, Foley argues that the expert's analysis was circular, and that's a great closing argument for the jury, but it's hardly summary judgment material. I see that my time is up.
You may finish your sentence, counsel.
I finished it, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Bauer, representing Quarles and Brady.
Yes, thank you. I'm Bill Bauer. I represent Quarles and Brady and Attorney Nicholas C., also appearing but not arguing as Attorney Michael A. Pope. The issue in this case is whether AccuWeb has provided sufficient evidence to carry its burden of proving actual injury and damages to a reasonable certainty. In their petition to this court, AccuWeb made the statement that this case calls for the application of new doctrine, and that was the beginning and the end of that theme from AccuWeb. In fact, AccuWeb has not set forth or proposed any new doctrine that this court consider. AccuWeb has not suggested that this court should overturn or modify any existing law. Instead, AccuWeb argues that the trial court and that the Court of Appeals misapplied existing law to the facts of the case. What is not in dispute here, then, is the law that AccuWeb has the burden to come forward with admissible evidentiary facts that prove actual injury and the amount of damages, if any, to a reasonable certainty. There are some things about a patent that I would like to address. The nature of a patent is important to an understanding of what this case is about. A patent is not needed to use an invention or any particular technology, either before a patent is issued or after a patent expires. I would also suggest that a patent imparts no inherent value to any particular technology or product. Here in this case, the patent at issue has no commercial value, and that is because there is no evidence in this record that anyone has sought to purchase an assignment of that patent, that anyone has sought to license the technology embodied in that patent, and there has never been any product put on the market by any other competitor or other manufacturer that incorporates the technology of the 414 patent.
Mr. Bauer, let me ask you, looking at this from the other side now, isn't the MISRO report enough to allow escaping from your motion for partial summary judgment? Isn't that enough with the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from that report to allow this case to move to a jury?
With all due respect, I don't believe so.
Why?
And it's because of the nature of the report itself. And we don't contest the diminution in value is, if properly presented, one way that damages can be assessed. But in this report, Mr. Goldfarb, who's the author of the report, stated that the purpose of his report, and this is right in the report and it's also in the briefs, is to determine the potential consequences of one or more competitors introducing products disclosed in the 414 patent. That was the purpose of that report, was to determine the potential consequences of one or more competitors introducing products disclosed in the 414 patent. Then, Mr. Goldfarb went on to say in the report, and this report was authored in 2002, you may recall there was an issue with it, the Court of Appeals picked up on that the date of the valuation of damages really is not relevant to any date in the case, which is true. But what Mr. Goldfarb said in this report, very tellingly, was that no loss should be considered based on discrepancies between base case and damage case from 1995 through 2002. But discrepancies from 2002, which was the date of the report, through 2008 should be considered. And this was because he recognized, and as much as said so, that there was no loss up to the time that he did his report in 2002. Then the purpose of the report, as he stated, was to measure the consequence of competitors coming into the market. And then what he did was assumed that competitors would enter the market. His assumption was regarding, he referred to Pacific Rim companies that could enter the market and penetrate the market in all markets, and that would cause AccuWeb to have to reduce the premium price that they paid or that they charged for their products, and as a result would reduce the value of the company. The problem with that is the assumption that there will be competitors is not only not backed up by any facts, it is in fact contradicted completely by the facts in this case. The record is clear that there has been no competitor who has manufactured, sold, used, or offered for sale any product that incorporates the technology described in the 414 patent.
Let me ask my question, and if my reasoning, and challenge my reasoning, if you will. Let's take the MISRO report and set it aside. And if instead I had a report that said that the value of AccuWeb
a more traditional appraisal report from a commercial appraiser. That the value of AccuWeb with this asset is so much, a couple million, and the value of the company without this asset is so much. That is, and if used, and they used the formula or the methodology of what a willing buyer would pay. If you had that kind of testimony, do you need then to have any testimony regarding an actual infringement or a potential infringement to a reasonable certainty?
I would submit yes, but it would depend a great deal on the assumptions of that report. I mean, that's not what you describe here is not the case here. The entire case here on Mr. Goldfarb's report is his comparing this base case versus this damage case. And in his assessment, he makes the express assumption that there will be competitors or that there are competitors that will enter this market. And we know that the record totally contradicts that. There are no competitors.
Well, again, let's say I'm a buyer.
Right.
And what I would be willing to pay for a company might be less if they're for a variety of circumstances. I mean, they no longer might have, they don't own the asset, they don't have the asset, it might be less. I guess I'm just not sure why you need to show an infringement. Why that has to, I mean, there's always...
Without some reasonable threat of an infringement, the patent doesn't add any value to the company. The value of a patent is in the ability to exclude others from that technology. That is what a patent is. It is a legal right to exclude others. But if there is no reasonable certainty, or any certainty, that there is anyone else to exclude, then the patent has no actual value. In this case, we know that AccuWeb has continued to sell this product and has done very well by their own testimony and has not lost any sales, lost any profits.
Let me just finish with this. I still get back to the very simple approach. It seems to me if you had the patent, I'd pay more for your company than if you didn't.
Maybe. And that has to involve a judgment as to what the patent is worth. And in this case, the only method that they have tried to show the diminution in value, they have not. In fact, Mr. Goldfarb admitted he did not do a patent evaluation. He did not try to value the patent. He tried to value this whole company. And then he said, well, now that they don't have this patent, there is this threat of some infringement, which he just assumed would occur, but in fact has never occurred.
Well, Mr. Bauer, couldn't you – I'm sorry, were you done? Justice Bradley, were you finished?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Can't you draw some reasonable inferences here from what happened with Phitek's offer, where the offer is more than $12 million, and as I understand it, after due diligence, it becomes a little more than $5 million, and they end up forfeiting $85,000? I mean, aren't there some reasonable inferences that can be drawn from that, given the loss of this patent?
There are a lot of inferences you might be able to draw from it, but...
I'm asking for reasonable inferences.
And that's what I was going to say, too. I don't think that they're... You know, the plaintiff's burden here is to prove, if they want to use that evidence, the burden has to be to prove that Phitek learned about the expiration of the 414 patent and used that as a motivation for withdrawing their offer. What happened was that Phitek had this, there was a letter of intent which contained an offer. There was this due diligence period. At the end of that, they withdrew their offer. The further discussion of $5.5 million was never even became an offer. It was just a point of discussion at that point. But there is no evidence in this record that they discovered that the 414 patent was, in fact, expired. And, in fact, at that time, AccuWeb didn't know that it was expired. There is no evidence in this record that that 414 patent played any role in Phitek's thinking process or motivation for wanting to purchase AccuWeb or for not wanting to purchase AccuWeb.
Even if you could draw the inference that Justice Crooks states, you would still argue that there was no evidence of certainty as to damages.
Correct.
All right, and let's see if I can approach this somewhat differently, approaching Justice Bradley's question. I'm reading from the reply brief of AccuWeb, and I'm reading from pages 2 to 3. And the bottom paragraph says, Mesereau based its opinion of diminished value on the fact that prospective buyers would weigh the risk underlined, that competitors would use the patent technology. So it appears that the plaintiff here is basing damage estimate on risk of competing use. And that goes on to 2 to 3. As I hear your argument is you don't base the damages, assuming diminished value is okay as a measure, you don't base that on the risk that a competitor will come in, but that you would say you have to base it on the fact that there will be competing use.
I couldn't hear that last part.
There will be competing use, because unless there is going to be competing use, that patent isn't worth very much in value, because there's no one out there trying to infringe.
Correct.
So I read them as saying they value it on a risk, and you're saying, no, you have to see if there's this actual possibility or actual will there be competing use? And you're saying, no, there won't be competing use.
I'm saying you are correct. And it seems to me that there has to be at least some evidence that there is some risk of competing use, and there is no risk of that in this record. The cases that we have cited to you, and I believe are consistent with Wisconsin law, is that the threat of future harm is not enough to establish injury. The threat of future harm is not enough to establish damages.
Counselor, wasn't the Teatsworth case a little bit different, though, in that no one in the class had ever had a problem with their motorcycle, and here there's no question the patent's gone. So there's a problem with the patent. So you start out on a kind of different level, don't you?
The Teatsworth case is analogous, but not 100%. I agree with you. But the problem, sure, there's a problem with the patent. The patent expired prematurely. But beyond that, they haven't shown injury or damages as a result of that. They are in the exact same position today that they would have been had they never had a patent in the first place for this technology.
Well, they can't license it to anybody today, and they could have licensed it if the patent had remained in effect, right? So they've lost that business opportunity.
There's no evidence that anyone is interested in licensing it.
Well, they can't really market it, though, and ask people if they'd like to be, because they would be getting stuck with the deceptive business practices.
Well, you're right. They don't have something that
they don't have anything to take to the marketplace.
Well, they had several years when they knew, but they didn't know they didn't have a patent. They could have done it then.
That's exactly right. I was just going to say that for many years, they went along with their business as normal, assuming they had a patent, and they, in fact, didn't have a patent, and it didn't make any difference.
No. Okay. Thank you.
I would like to speak briefly to the issue of the FITEC offer and just to point out to the court that I don't think there is a reasonable inference from the fact that this offer was withdrawn supports the notion that it was withdrawn because they learned that there was a patent that had expired prematurely. In fact, no one knows why FITEC withdrew their offer. The AccuWeb is the party that has the burden to come forth with the evidence, and they took no discovery of the only people who would know either what FITEC knew or why FITEC did what they did, and that's the people at FITEC. There was absolutely no attempt to obtain an affidavit or any discovery from the people at FITEC. It is hearsay, and I want to come back to the Mayberry case because Mr. Axelrod and AccuWeb have argued that the Mayberry case stands for the proposition that the Biskers can testify to their own opinion as to the value of their company, which is true, but they didn't do that in this case. They never gave any opinion What they did was they just said, we heard what FITEC said, and we think they're lying, and we think they know, we know what their real reason is. But in their own deposition, Mr. Bisker said that he was basing that on an assumption, and he said it was intuitive. He had absolutely no way to know that. And I see that my time is up, and Mr. Cavelli will pick up from here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bauer. Mr. Cavelli, representing Foley and Lardner and Harry Engstrom.
Good noon. It seems the role of a defense lawyer to get before whoever he's making this presentation, either at lunchtime or dinnertime.
High noon.
I think what we're talking about is the difference between the potential or possibility of damage occurring and the requirement in Wisconsin that the plaintiff must come forward with proof to establish that such damage likely, to a reasonable probability, has occurred or will occur. And, Justice Bradley, you were asking about, well, wouldn't a reasonable buyer pay less for a company because it no longer has a patent? That may or may not be true, but you also have to remember that's only half of the equation of what fair market value is. The other half of the equation is what would the reasonable seller take for that company? AccuWeb would not take and did not take the low ball figure estimate of anybody. They walked away, and I think it should be pointed out, Mr. Goldfarb in no way in rendering his opinions referred to or relied upon the FITEC intent to purchase. These are two disconnected bits of information. There is no connection between the two. In other words, Mr. Goldfarb didn't say, because of that, I draw some inference. There's just no connection, number one. Number two, the actual FITEC offer was for $9 million cash plus some other accounts receivable and whatnot that took it to $12.5 million. They reduced their, I believe, their cash offer to 5.5, which means that their total offer is $9 million. And AccuWeb was not interested in that. So there's absolutely no evidence in the record that the fair market value of what the fair market value of AccuWeb was. Secondly, AccuWeb, and this is the crucial point, never sold. Its business was not liquidated or terminated because it no longer had this patent. It did not sell its product, its company, at a loss to anybody. It didn't sell it at a depressed price. It continued to hold those income-producing assets. It continued to receive the revenues and the profits from the technology that the 414 patent and 573 patent described.
Counselor, at the time that AccuWeb turned down the lowball offer from FITEC, it thought it had the patent. So if FITEC knew it didn't, they knew more than AccuWeb did at that point in time, correct?
Correct. And that just goes to show how insignificant the existence of the patent was to AccuWeb's business. It didn't even know its patent had expired for 2.5 or 3 years.
Well, a patent is never something you check all the time unless somebody else is using your invention, and then you're going to haul them up on it, right?
And what this may or may not be true, all right? It came up when they came up for their second maintenance payment, and Mr. Engstrom went to check and said, gee, you didn't pay your first. This patent's been expired. So my point is, they admit and concede, we don't have our patent since December of 1995. We don't change the way we do business at all because we don't know about it for a while. And even after we know about it, we don't change the way we do our business. And we admit we can't prove we lost $1 of revenue or $1 of profit because we don't have a patent. We made as much money as we could with this patent as we did without, that there was no difference. We can't show we lost a dollar. Now, what I'm saying is this patent's going to expire even if all the maintenance fees are paid in 2008. That patent has a limited life. You can only exclude people for a certain period of time. There is no evidence in this case that that patent had any value to any third party. There's no evidence that they introduced that anybody would pay to license it. In fact, the evidence is this patent only afforded protection in the United States. They sold across the world. Since 1998, they've been selling this product. No competitor anywhere in the world outside the United States from 1998 to date has copied this invention and sold it. Since 1995, the patent was expired in the United States. Everybody was completely free in the United States to use the invention without paying AccuWeb a nickel. Nobody, not one competitor, has copied the invention. There is no, if they can do it for free, why would they pay AccuWeb a licensing fee, or why would they pay to buy that patent?
Well, maybe that, it's incorporated in the equipment, isn't it, that is made at AccuWeb?
Pardon me?
Isn't the patent incorporated in the equipment?
The patented technology is part of the equipment that they sell.
Right, so you'd have to have someone that's in the same business selling the same kind of stuff in order to want to use it to make similar equipment, wouldn't you?
And that's the only way AccuWeb would be hurt by the use of the patented equipment in their business, is if a competitor who they were competing with took their invention, was selling product with it, and was taking away profits from them. And the undisputed evidence is we have no proof of that. They concede that. But what I'm trying to say is we have another problem. For example, this potential loss was never realized. I own stock, very little, but I own some stock. My stock goes up and down in value. I don't sell that stock. I still hold it. When it's down in value, I have not realized a loss because I still own that stock, and it may go up and down tomorrow. I realize the loss when I sell it, because at that point, I fix what that stock was worth to me. That's the same with the business. This business, AccuWeb didn't sell its assets. Its business can go up and down in value. If it sold its business back in 2002 when their expert wrote his report, it would have fixed their loss. They would have then actually sold their business. They could no longer earn profits from that business. They could no longer get that flow of income. Then this court could say, look at an expert's testimony and say, well, what should they have gotten if they had a patent? But that didn't happen. They didn't sell their business because they believed there were going to be no competitors. And my proof of that is their own expert. Their own expert's base case, if you will, is based upon AccuWeb's August 2002 7-year growth plan. This plan was what AccuWeb put into place well after they knew the patent was expired, and like I think 6 years after the patent was expired. This is what Mr. Goldfarb used as his base case to determine damages. And what Mr. Goldfarb said is, you know, in valuing the assets of a company, what you do is you take the present value of the future flow of profits. You take the present value of the future flow of profits, and if you're going to sell it in 2002, you look at profits, in his case, the next 7 years, which coincidentally ended with 2008 when this patent would have expired, and you take the present value of that, and that is the value of your company. And he said the damage case here is what AccuWeb's management said they would earn with no competitors. And, in fact, they have had no competitors. And, in fact, they have, over those years, those 7 years to date, earned the profits that they said they would get in their damage case. If you then allow them to obtain damages on a hypothetical sale back in 2002, they will have collected over the succeeding years the profits that they earned, and they admit there's no diminution in profit whatsoever, no diminution in revenue because we lost our patent. They will have gotten those profits year by year by year. You would then award them those same profits again in terms of this hypothetical sale that never occurred back in 2002. They would recover the same profits twice. And we're not saying that you can't prove a claim with expert testimony. We're saying that this expert's testimony was fatally flawed.
Tell me, what is the fatal flaw, precisely?
All right. There were several. The first was it was circular. He assumed that by January 2003, one or more competitors would copy the invention, undersell it, and essentially put AccuWeb out of business in a year and a half. The undisputed evidence is that never occurred. He assumed the very damage he purported to prove by assuming that competitors would come in and undersell with the invention and put them out of business.
Is that the only way that a company may lose value as a result of that having a patent? It seems to me that the value of a company is not merely the value of the patent, it's the value of the company with a patent versus the value of a company without a patent.
Well, the value of the company, according to their, according to AccuWeb's expert, is the flow of profits that can be income that can be generated in the future from those assets. And in this case, there is no evidence, and in fact, AccuWeb has conceded, we can't prove we lost $1 of revenue or $1 of profits because this patent expired. So I'm saying, based on their own expert's testimony, the value of that company has not diminished because the flow of profits has not diminished based on the assets that they had. The presence of that patent or the absence did not change the future profits. They have no evidence of that. Not $1, they said, not $1 of lost profit. The next point is this merely, like Teatsworth, a potential injury or a potential damage? And it is a potential damage, and in Teatsworth, the value of these motorcycles was deemed to be diminished because of this general problem with the engines on the motorcycles. And they were saying, gee, when we go to sell our motorcycles, you know, we're probably going to get less money. Because, gee, a buyer, as Justice Bradley said, rather patent, no patent, would say, I don't want a motorcycle that's probably got a bad engine, so I would pay less for it. And this court said, that's not enough. You got to actually show that your motorcycle likely has a problem and will likely actually result in a monetary loss to you, and you haven't proven that. And that's exactly this case. They haven't proven that it is likely that the absence of the patent will result in a competitor copying their product and hurting their business. They haven't proven that when we sell our business, we will actually get less money for it than we would if we had the patent. And in fact, if they continue to own the business past July of 2008, they would never have that patent. Because the patent, that's the full term. That patent's done if they pay all their maintenance fees. This is not something for the life of the company. It's for a limited term. Finally, it's the double recovery. We submit their own proof established that they received those profits, the same profits they would have earned with that technology with a patent. They didn't need a patent to use that technology. They only needed a patent to keep others from using that technology. And there was nobody else using it, that they got those same profits. They admit they didn't lose $1 of profits because they didn't have a patent. Now they want to recover it again based upon a hypothetical sale that never occurred, that they never actually realized a loss on. So we're saying there's no new law here. The court applied the existing law in summary judgment. There's no dispute that AccuWeb had the burden of proof to prove that they likely had or likely would actually suffer a monetary loss in the diminution in value of their company. By settlement, we got rid of all the other elements of damages. This is the only element of damage left, this claim for diminution. And all they ever showed was, yeah, we haven't lost a nickel yet, but we could if we had sold it, or we might in the future if we sell it, suffer a loss, but they never proved that that was likely. And their own expert, I hope this was the good cross that was referred to, their own expert, when asked at the deposition, I said, well, there has been no competitor copying the product to date, yes. And would you agree that it would be pure speculation for you to opine that there would ever be such a competitor before in the next 5 years, which took it past July of 2008, and he said, yes, it would be speculation.
You must have thought you'd died and gone to heaven, didn't you?
I thought that was a basis for summary judgment because they failed to prove they had suffered an actual monetary loss or likely would. And I think our cases, just to conclude, indicate that it's not enough to suffer a legal loss. That's not enough to recover actual monetary damages, that you actually have to show you have likely suffered or will likely suffer actual monetary loss, and that's where they failed here. Thank you very much.
What I'm getting from your presentation is that if they had sold to Phytech, they would be in a much stronger position.
Only if they sold at a loss. And we don't know whether they would have or not.
Well, I mean, if they had sold at $5 million or so.
If they had sold at a loss, they would then have fixed their loss. They could no longer use those assets. And then you would be able to, by expert testimony, take a look at, okay, this is what they actually got. Did the fact that they didn't have a patent cause them to receive less than they would have received if they had a patent? But you would have had an actual fixation of the event. The trial in this matter is no different than November of 2002 as far as fixing the date. Unless they sell their corporation on the date of trial is just another day. Nothing happens on the date of trial with respect to their realizing a loss.
But and now come right back at me, but what I'm sensing is that you would, in effect, have the law punish them for not engaging in what they would view as self-destructive conduct.
Oh, I disagree. In other words, if in fact the loss of the patent crippled their company, they would sell, and they would be mitigating their damage, and they would sell their company at whatever price they could get. In this case, I'm saying they didn't suffer any loss. They didn't prove that they suffered a loss, and the proof is in the pudding because rather than selling their company for $5.5 or $9 million, they said, heck, this loss of this patent isn't going to diminish the value. We're going to keep our company, and we're going to bet on the fact that nobody comes in and copies our product, and we're going to make just as much money as we always have. And they were right.
Counselor, but they didn't know they didn't have a patent when they refused the $5.5 million. So, I mean, you kind of lose me on part of that. I mean, they weren't saying, look, we got a mess here now. We don't have this patent, so we got to take a lower value and mitigate our damages. They thought they had a patent.
When they learned that they no longer had a patent, they didn't go out and sell it for $5.5 million either. They kept the company going, and they developed a plan that says we're going to grow and get better across the world. And the evidence is they didn't lose a dollar of profit because they didn't have this patent. And if you value a company by its future flow of profits, how can you claim the company's diminished in value when you haven't lost any revenue or any profits? I've had the red light here for quite some time.
Thank you, Mr. Cavelli. Mr. Axelrod, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I want to correct two misstatements. First, this patent expires well into 2009, not 2008. Second, page 3 of the Misereau report doesn't talk about a sale in 2002. It says, and I quote, "We conclude that the premature expiration of the 414 patent has fundamentally impaired the fair market value of AccuWeb by adding a material risk factor which diminishes the probability that the company can achieve the future cash flows forecast in its business plan. Now, I think it's important. This case has to be viewed not in terms of 2007, but it has to be viewed when the record closed in the trial court in 2005. At that point in time, there were 4-plus years left on that patent. The trial court was looking forward, was looking into the future. So was the expert looking into the future. And what we really have as a proper analogy here is a real estate appraisal. If somebody came into this court and said that in order to collect damages for diminution of value of real estate because the stream next door, the trout stream, is now polluted, one doesn't have to show that they attempted to sell or that the property was actually sold. This court accepts real estate appraisals all the time, and this case should be valued no differently. I think it's just totally unfair for defendants to argue that somehow there has to be an infringement or somehow there has to be a sale. And what the Beasley court said is they reasoned that a patent can have a fair market value outside the confines of a patent infringement action, and it's precisely because it increases the value of the company. Risk diminishes value, whether or not there's an infringer knocking at the door or whether or not there's a potential purchaser knocking at the door. And we don't know what happened since 2005. The record closed then. It's not appropriate for me to tell this court what's happened since 2005. And I won't. In the Lewandowski case, Lewandowski versus Continental Casualty Company, I think that's the case that this court should follow on damages, because there this court said that it's the duty of courts to fashion a remedy in situations where value is difficult. And this is precisely that type of case. Valuation is difficult. And that was an excellent closing argument that we just heard to a jury. But because valuation is difficult, that shouldn't stand as a barricade to the courthouse door. And the problem, I think, with the defendant's argument is the problem that the U.S. Supreme Court observed long ago in the 40s, in the case of Bigelow versus RKO Pictures, where they said that any other rule would enable the wrongdoer to profit by his wrongdoing at the expense of the plaintiff. And there certainly, after 1998, when it was discovered that the patent was no longer in force, there were certainly good and compelling reasons not to go out and try to sell the company. And I think you pointed it out well when you said that you'd have an unfair, you'd have a deceptive practices problem. Unless if you went out and you want to say, gee, I want to sell my company, but I have to disclose to you, so I don't myself end up as a defendant in a lawsuit, that the leading asset of the company had expired. So I think that because the plaintiffs were in that position as a result of the acts of the defendant, that shouldn't be held against them.
Mr. Axelrod, does the value of AccuWeb depend on how high the risk is that there'll be a competitor?
Value of AccuWeb depends upon the sum of its assets, including its most principal asset, the 414 patent.
But it's the risk, isn't it?
It's the risk.
There'll be as a competitor. That's what you say on pages 2 and 3.
Right. It's the risk.
So if there's a low risk that there's a competitor coming in, that won't affect the value very much.
If
there's a high risk, it will.
It's the risk that diminishes the value, and that again goes to the amount of damages, not as to whether or not you should have the ability to claim damages. Certainly, the defendant should be able to argue that damages are reduced because, in this case, at least in their view, there's a lower risk. Whereas, I'm sure the plaintiff's experts will testify if this case goes back to trial that there's a higher risk. I want to just briefly digress.
Had a couple of sentences, Mr. Axelrod.
Oh, I see my time's up. I wanted to just answer the point that was raised about FITEC. No one has identified another reason for FITEC's withdrawal. FITEC said economic reasons. Economic reasons could include the loss of the patent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Axelrod, and thank you, Mr. Bauer and Mr. Covelli for arguing on yet another summary judgment case and whether or not you fit within the legal requirements of a summary judgment. That concludes our hearing on 05-AP-3190, AccuWeb versus Foley and Lardner. The court is in recess for lunch and will reconvene at 1:30. The students should stay if they wish, and Justice Ziegler will be out shortly.